Good morning. So, last time we started talking about the hardware we use to build our processors, and we learned that, well, we need some place to store data, and this we need even for, you know, simple things like, you know, if we want to like count up. Like, we can't just rely on wires holding values because, you know, if we want to connect that value to something to, say, do the next step of a computation, well, if we just do that naively, we end up with this kind of circular dependency where things become unstable because we don't actually have a firm decision on when things should or should not change. So our fix for that is this component we called a register, which stores a value explicitly, rather than kind of implicitly that wires do, and outputs that stored value, and importantly, it only changes what value it has stored when it gets a signal. So there is a signal we call the clock signal, which is going to be common for our whole processor, and it's just a sort of periodic signal which periodically has what we call a rising edge, and that's what our registers are going to read a new input of. And so the overall effect of this is that our registers feed into circuits that do calculation, which feed back into registers. And we do one calculation based on this current stored value. And hopefully after that's done, our clock signal rises, and we start doing the next calculation because we store the value of the current results to use in the next calculation. So once we had our values being stored, we learned that, oh, well, we need to make decisions in our circuits. And one example we had was that if we wanted to, like, do different things for different instructions, well, we want something that kind of looks like an if-then. So what does that look like for a circuit? And sort of the design we learned was this thing called a MUX. So this was something that kind of works like a gate where we take in some set of inputs and a selection signal and choose, based on that selection signal, one of the inputs. And we had this extremely abstract representation of MUXes that we're going to use in HCLRS, where our assumption is that the hardware programming language is going to figure out all this complication of how do I go from your conditional expressions to a selection signal. And that's going to be something we're not going to worry about, that's someone else's problem. And once we had that, we could build a simple processor that does some choice of instructions. Well, almost. We need one more thing. We need to get our instructions. And so we have this instruction memory component that's, we're going to assume for now, works by we put in an input address and we get the value at that address with some delay. When we talk about caches, we'll maybe look a little more about what's really going on. But that's our model for now. And by some delay, I mean within the current clock cycle because, well, we want to use the result before, you know, the next rising edge of the clock so we can store the values we compute based on the instruction we get in the current cycle. The end of the current cycle, I should say. We learned that in our processor, the instruction memory is going to read 10 bytes. Why 10 bytes? Because that's the size of the largest instruction. So far, we haven't actually dealt with any of the instructions that are larger than 1 byte, but we're going to need to. And that's where we got up to the NOP halt CPU. So before I sort of review one thing we kind of went over very quickly last time, which was how did we figure out how to extract the opcode part, and exactly where that is. Any other questions on things we covered last time? Yes?
Can we use the MUX to another MUX to go to?
Question is, can we use a MUX to determine another MUX to use? You can absolutely nest case expressions or have a MUX go into a wire that controls another MUX. Yeah. Or just calculating a value, you can use that value wherever. Other questions? So we had our not halt CPU, and one thing we mentioned was that a common point of confusion is how our instructions map into little endian number. So when we read 10 bytes from memory, we said we always use little endian, so it becomes a 10-byte number. And we have a way of extracting bits of the number, and so for the first time, we have a way of identifying bits by number, and we have to choose, well, is bit 0 in the most significant place, the least significant place, or something else? And we've chosen the least significant place. So when we read our, say, this instruction here, this A02F, A0 is the least significant byte because little endian. The A, which is usually the part we're interested, is bits 4 through 8 in our extraction syntax. 4 as the base, and 8 is the maximum, because remember, the maximum is exclusive. And this often confuses people, because you look at this diagram, which is the primary one we use, because it's probably the most convenient form for manually encoding and decoding things. And you say, okay, so bits 0 through 7 are leftmost. Therefore, my opcode must be bit 0. But no, that's not how it works. These are bit 0 through 4. This is 4 through 8. Because this is a list of bytes with the lowest address byte leftmost. So perhaps it would be have been better to show you this diagram, but this is less convenient to use for manually encoding and decoding things. But this has the bits sort of laid out in a way which is more natural when we think of how they map to a little endian number. Where our address 0, offset is here, 1, and so on. And tells us, you know, we have bits 0 through 7 here. This is bits 0 through 4, our secondary opcode. 4 through 8 are our primary opcode. Our RA, if it's present in the instruction, is bits 12 through 16, not 8 through 12. And bits 8 through 12 are RB, if it's present. Some questions about this mapping of bit numbers to parts of instructions? Okay, so once we do that, we end up with this not halt CPU. So what I've done is I said, okay, our stat needs to depend on the instruction. So I'm going to get i10 bytes. I'm going to extract that primary opcode field. And if it's NOP, I'm going to do one thing. If it's HALT, I'm going to do another. You might say, what is this capital NOP and capital HALT thing? So this is just, we could have written this here, this NOP. Why is this laggy today? This is just 0B0001. And this here is just 0B0000. There's a bunch of predefined constants. You can find a table of them in the ACRLS documentation we link from the lab, or at the top of the course website. So these are just for convenience, so you don't have to like look up what the opcode for everything is. But we could have just written the opcode. 0B is a binary constant, so writing it in binary. So this is saying if it's NOP, we keep going. If it's HALT, we stop. And otherwise, we trigger an invalid instruction. And we can run this. Yes. Oh, the question is, what is this line that assigns to PC? So remember, PC is this signal here. That's the input to the instruction memory. So if we don't have that, all we've created is this like circuit that sets the PC register. We haven't actually connected anything to the instruction memory.
So the input is PC and the output is
i10 bytes. The output of the instruction memory is i10 bytes. So if we didn't connect anything to PC, we kind of complained that, oh, sorry, I don't know what i10 bytes should be. Other questions? Yeah.
Does the slicing work the same as lists in Python that you have a for included, eight not included?
Question, is this for included, eight not included? Yes. Other questions? Okay, so we could. So we could run this. So if I have a copy of that code, well, I guess a slightly different version of that code, and say something to run, I can run this like so. And I get something that actually halts. It says halted in some state. So on. We had that invalid instruction. So if I run this on, say, something which has a non-nop or halt instruction, it will also halt but give me a different message, like so, like this invalid instruction message. Not sure if I pointed out. So you notice that the output of HTLRS we have here, we have it decoding the instruction it actually read for us. It doesn't mean we decode it correctly. It just for your device. Okay, so we have nop and halt. I guess questions about the demo before I move on? Sure. Okay, so we have nop and halt. Let's extend this to nop and jump. So right now, we're computing the next program counter value by adding one, because that's the size of nop and halt instructions. If we want to add jump, you know, we're going to have to change that computation. So I'm going to just move it around on my diagram, and I'm going to say, okay, you know, we don't always want to add one. Sometimes we want to choose where the jump goes to. So then we have to figure out, well, how do we extract where the jump goes to? And we'll work on that later. But basically, it's going to be part of the output of the instruction memory, part of that i10 bytes is going to be the location the jump goes to. So we're going to have a mux that chooses between that and our plus one for nop, the size of a nop or a halt instruction. So questions about this? Sort of overall design for doing nop and jump and halt. Okay, so let's this like so, and I've done some things a little differently. So one thing you might notice is I've decided, oh, I kept writing i10 bytes for .8. I've just made a wire named iCode. The names I'm going to use here are mostly to match our textbook. This is not me endorsing this naming convention, as you will see in a second. So you have iCode, which is 4 through 8, and we need to extract the destination of the jump. So I looked at my table of instructions, and I learned, oh, the jump is bits 4, 8 through 72 is where that dest field is. So I'm going to extract it by using that range. So, and just give it a convenient name. I could have written i10 bytes 8 through 72 everywhere dest is learned later on instead. I just wanted this to be a little more readable for me. So I have my old calculation of the next instruction as plus one, which worked for nop and halt. And I have my calculation for jumps of take the destination field from the instruction. And I combine this into a signal I call valp. Why do I call it valp? Because that's what our textbook calls it. The textbook's convention is that things beginning with val are 64-bit signals. Do I think this is a good name? No, but I want you to be able to read the textbook and figure out what's going on, so that's why I'm using it on the slide. Yes? So the question is, if I was grabbing an immediate value from an IR move queue instruction, would I also refer to this valpy? Our textbook does not refer to immediate values from IR move queues and so on as valpy, because valpy is the value that's the output of this MUX. That's what our textbook's definition is. So it's the output of the MUX that's going to go into the PC. So we don't use an IR move queues immediate to set the program counter, so they give it a different name. Other questions? Okay, so we have our valpy. Something else you may notice is that I have a default value here that I've put in. So in HTLRS, you are required to have a default value for all muxes. This is not something our textbook's HTL requires, but we found that this dramatically decreases errors to require. And in this case, I chose a default value that is just a arbitrary constant that will be very apparent to me when I see it in the output. So I can know, oh, wait a moment, the reason something's happening is I've chosen the default value which I didn't think was relevant. And the reason I wouldn't think it's relevant is because, you know, hopefully we halt in that case. We halt with invalid instruction in that case. So questions about the code here. Yes?
So I know, like, within these code blocks, like stat and valpy, for example, the order doesn't matter, but does the order matter, like, would you put stat above?
The question is, does the order matter if I put stat above LP, is you're asking?
Yeah.
So the order of the assignments doesn't matter. The only real place we've seen where order matters is the order of things in muxes. In case expressions. Other than that, doesn't matter. Yes?
Why are we adding 1 to the program counter since the instruction is 10 byte long?
So the question is, why are we adding 1 since the instruction is 10 byte long? So we're adding 1 if the I code is NOP. So in that case, the instruction is 1 byte long. And for the conditional jump, that instruction is actually 9 bytes long. But we aren't adding 9 in that case because, well, we're only implementing unconditional jump. If we were implementing conditional jump, we would want to add 9 sometimes. We're only doing an unconditional jump, so we want to go to the destination of the jump every time. Yes?
So is this essentially what we're supposed to do for the unconditional jump part of the homework?
The question is this what you're supposed to do for the unconditional jump part of HCL2, the homework assignment after the lab? Yes. Yeah. Other questions? Okay, so we can show some things about running this. So I have a copy of my mop and jump CPU, and I have a program that uses jumps a bunch. So I can just run that. By spelling the name of the interpreter correctly. And we can look at, we can see each step, we can see the instruction that's fetched. So in the decoding of the instruction that's fetched, note that in the case here, you know, in our first instruction, we loaded more than that NOP. Like, there's a DEST value for DEST. The decoding is just acknowledging, oh, if you're decoding this correctly, you only see the NOP instruction and the rest you're gonna ignore. So we have this version. I'd like to point out that there's some debugging features in our interpreter that I would like you to be familiar with. So one is that there's this debug option, which will show you the value of every single named wire. So we can see here that it tells us, oh, we set the PC to 00 during this first cycle, and that's what we read from memory, is that integer. And notice that, well, we decoded it as not because, well, it's a NOP instruction followed by some junk that's a part of an X instruction. But we actually did read part of the next instruction, we just aren't going to use it the way we've designed our processor. And we also have a table of values of every single wire here. And we have this for each cycle. So this is what I have out there for debugging things. See through it. So for example, here we can see that we got our jump instruction here, and jump instruction plus some extra junk that we aren't using, and that dest decoded to 13. So this is handy if you're like, you were worried, did I get the wrong bits for dest? You can check. Okay. And I redirected this to a paging program, but you could redirect this to a file, like so. This is something you may or may not have learned. 2150, I don't know how much shell stuff we teach. Also, there's also an interactive mode, which will ask you to press enter after each cycle, if you would like to do that. And in addition, if you want less output, there's a quiet mode, which will only show you the output at the end. So that's questions about HCLRS usage. Yeah.
What was it, the bar less?
The bar, oh, the. So less is a program which outputs things with. I can should probably do. So less is a program which outputs things in a way where I can like scroll through them in the terminal. You can also do it on a file, so I can like do like less of, I guess I should have a multi-page file as an example, so I can like less the make file and scroll through it. Other questions? Okay, so other things in demo. So, right, the, so we have a tool that's provided by our textbook authors called YIS, which is an interpreter. So it is a reference implementation of Y86. So if you want to see what is supposed to happen, it's an implementation by our textbook authors that will tell you, oh, it's supposed to take, you know, when I run on a not jump, it's supposed to take 7 steps and change nothing in registers or memory. Or if I run it on some more complicated program, so, yeah, like, say this one, it will tell me, oh, this program is supposed to change register RCX from 0 to ACE, and so on. So this is a reference for telling you what your processor, when it's fully implemented, is supposed to do. Obviously, like if I ran this same y86.yo file, executable that is, on my not jump CPU, I wouldn't get this because I haven't done anything to change registers yet. But it's a good reference for knowing, figuring out what's supposed to happen, even if you like write your own test case. Okay, so, speaking of changing registers, let's talk about implementing another simple processor. So we did NOP and jump, So we talked about manipulating the program counter and reading from the instruction memory. So the next big thing we need to worry about that we haven't kind of seen yet is accessing registers. And we saw that we have kind of a built-in component that's basically just a set of built-in registers that represent RAX, RCX, and so on. We could have you make this yourself, but instead we have a component we call a register file that contains them. There's two reasons for this. So one, it's just to save you time because it's just kind of tedious work that's more of a topic for other classes about how we build something that stores a bunch of register values in a way that you can easily access them. And another reason is because when we're doing like grading, it's really handy to know what the values of registers are and not have to tease out where did you decide to store the register value. So as an example, we're going to talk about implementing a processor that executes only adds. So this is what our add instruction looks like. It takes a opcode byte, which has 6 for the primary opcode and a 0 for the secondary opcode. And then it takes 2 4-bit register numbers. And for now, we won't have other instructions. Later on, we can add back math and halt, and we'll see how. So to use this, we need to use our register file, which is going to be a built-in component. So this is essentially some circuit which contains a bunch of registers inside it. We're not going to be too concerned with how that you build that. But to make that work, it has a bunch of inputs and outputs. So it has 6 inputs and 2 outputs. Probably the most straightforward part of this is that you can put in a register number, which is going to happen to match the register numbers that appear in our instruction encoding, because that's really convenient. And you can get the register's value. So the register number is a 4-bit number. So we put in a 4-bit number, which is the red value here, and we get, with some delay, but in the same clock cycle, the register's 64-bit value that it's storing, which is the blue value here. And we have 2 inputs for register numbers because we have some instructions that need to read 2 registers, like add. So for add, we need the values of 2 different registers. That's so we have 2 inputs to read them because we want to read them at the same time. We also have the ability to write 2 registers. And the way this works is that we're going to input to this register number signal, the 4-bit number, which is the index of the register we want to write to. And we're going to input the value we want to write in a corresponding 64-bit signal. And we have 2 inputs for the register number to write and 2 inputs for the register value to write that correspond to them. Why do we need 2? Because the pop instruction writes to 2 registers. It writes to RSP, the stack pointer, and the register specified by its operand. So to support that instruction, we're going to have 2 registers being written at once, rather than needing to do that instruction over 2 different cycles. And the way this is going to work is that essentially when you input a register number on this write number signal, it's going to wire up the data to write to the correct actual register. And like our normal registers, this is going to mean that when there's that rising edge of the clock, we're going to store that value. So the actual write of the register won't happen until the end of the clock cycle. And importantly, this means that you can read the old value of a register while you're setting up a write of the new value. Because you're going to do the read before that rising edge and like maybe do a calculation, like an add. Like, we'll see. Yes?
Why would you need, like, write register numbers and data to write if you're, like, storing the result in a register?
Why would you need a write register number and data to write? So if we're storing the result in a register, so the registers are in here. So the write register number tells us which register to write to. So, for example, if we're writing to RAX, we're going to input 0, RCX 1, and you saw this table earlier in our instruction code. But to store in that register here, we also need to supply the value we're storing, and that's what goes in this data to write signal. That answer your question?
Isn't the value that, isn't it computed during like the process?
So the question is, where is the value that we're writing computed? So the way we're going to use this is that we're going to have typically some circuit which takes these values, does some operation, and ends up with an input over here. Yes.
So you have like the red and the green arrows. Does that indicate that those two like ports are connected?
So the question I have, things red and green. So we have, does that represent that they're connected? Yes. So the one write register number is paired with one data to write signal. So what our textbook says, and what typically people refer to this, is that we have two write ports. And the port consists of two signals because we need to tell the register file two different things to write. We need to tell it where to write and what to write. That answer your question? Other questions? Yes, back there. So the question is, would the number of outputs be different with a different number of registers we're accessing? And no. So the number of outputs we have is how many, I guess, with, if a different number of registers accessed at once, I should say. It would be different. So this is saying we can access two registers at a time. So if we wanted to access four registers at a time, we need to have twice as many read register numbers and twice as many outputs. As far as the number of registers that we have, that's going to affect how wide these register number signals are. So here, right now, they're 4 bits wide because we need 4 bits to specify which register. So if we wanted to say support 32 registers, they need to be 5 bits wide. Yes?
So is the register
So the question is, does the register file only output things when you input into the read register, read number? And the answer is kind of. So the issue is that if we think of how this works physically, there's going to be some wires, and they have a voltage on them, whether we want them to or not, which means they have a value on them, which means the register is always outputting something. It just might not be something useful. Other questions? Okay, so related to this issue of these wires always having values, something we might think about is this wire here always has a value, and this wire here always has a value. And we don't want to write to two different registers all the time. But it seems like we're kind of setting ourselves up to do that because we have to put a value there. And this is the reason why our textbook authors decided to not have 16 registers anymore, but to have 15. So what we'll do is that we'll say register number 15 is going to be special, and it's going to be how you specify don't write to anything. And in HTLRS, it's represented by the special constant regnon. It's just 15, because that's the special register number. And for reading registers, if you specify 15, you'll always get 0. Okay, some questions? Okay, and all these signals have names in HTLRS, which are also in the README on the website. So you don't need to memorize them, or you can also refer to the slide. So we have two read ports, so you specify the register number to read in source A and source B, and you get the value of that register in output A and output B. These are names are slightly different than the textbook, but we think in a useful way. You can input the register number to write in DESTE and the corresponding value in input E for the first port, and DESTM and input M for the second port. These, the A, B, E, M is based on our textbook. The way we're going to find out it works is A and B are just first and second. E for execute, where we do computation, M for memory. That's the convention our textbook chose. But you don't have to use them that way. They're just, they work the same way, they just have different names. Questions? Okay, so let's build our AdQ CPU. So we want to do AdQ. So we're going to have a program counter. We're going to fetch an instruction based on that. We're going to figure out whether it's an add or a halt or whatever. Then we're going to, we're going to get from here, our register numbers. So we want to take those two register numbers from the instruction and send them to the register file to read those two registers. So like if it's RCX, RDX, we want to send the identifiers for RCX and RDX to the register file to get what value's actually in those. So then we're going to get an output from the register file. We're going to add it together. So we're going to have some circuit that doesn't add. Well, what do we want to do with that add? If it's an add instruction, we want to write it out back to the register file. So we're going to input that into the register file. And we also need to specify where to write to. So we input to this -d signal the corresponding value, which is going to be the same as our second, our B register. So questions about this diagram I made so far? Yes?
So we can read within a clock cycle, but it takes one clock cycle to write?
So we can read within a clock cycle, but it takes a clock cycle to write? Yes. So we always write at the rising edge of a clock cycle when we're transitioning to the next cycle. But we can do all our reads of the instruction memory or registers within a clock cycle. Yes? So question is, what's happening in the split and convert opcode boxes? So our instruction, you remember, is the 60 RxX ROI. So the split is just a box which extracts the RxX and ROI parts. So the HTLRS code for this is just going to be to select the bits that correspond to those. The convert opcode is that, well, we have this add instruction, looks like this, but we also have to worry about a halt, which looks like this, right? Or other instructions, and that's just saying we're going to process the opcode field, this 6 or 0, and figure out what to set stat to.
So if the opcode for 0 would nothing happen past that split, or would it just...
The question is, if the opcode were 0, would nothing happen past that split? No! So that is a bug in this. And if the opcode were 0, we'd still try to do the rest of the add. And we need to do something later on to fix that. Other questions? Okay, so let's look at an example of how this works. So here's my simple program. I have add RAX RDX, add RBX RCX. So initially our PC is 0, it points to, so we fetch the RAX RDX instructions, so we get 0, the register identifier for RAX, and 2, the register identifier for RDX on source A and source B, which means we get the values of them, and we're saying in this example that they are initially 10 and 30. So we take 10 and 30, we add them together to get 40, and 40 is on the input to this value to write signal, and the register number 2 for RDX is on the input of -d. So at the rising edge of the clock, we're going to actually write 40. So in the next cycle, RDX contains 40. So what's going to happen next based on what I've drawn? So there's actually a problem here, which is, what does the program counter become? I didn't actually draw something indicating that here. And if this were HTLRS code, I'd get a complaint that, hey, wait a moment, you didn't set your PC register to anything. It needs to be connected to something, just a floating wire. You don't know what that's going to do. So to make this work and not just have who knows what happen, I'm going to need to add something to get to the next PC here, because my add instructions are 2 bytes, that opcode part and the register numbers. I'm just going to add 2, because that's the only instruction I care about right now. Questions? Yes. So the second cycle. So why is RDX 40? That is what the first cycle did. Remember, the writes happen at that rising edge between the cycles. So if we are reading the value during the first cycle, during the initial cycle, I should say, which is presumably cycle 0 with this number, well, I guess cycle 1, yeah, then we would get 30 for RDX, and we did, because we added 30 and 10 to get 40. If we're reading it during the next cycle, we would get 40. Does that answer your question? So we can write this out in HTLRS code with the names we saw earlier. And in this case, I've done some sort of convenience variable. So I've defined RA and RB to be the register A and B extracted from the instruction. Right. And the opcode to be 4 through 8. I've omitted the code that says stat from this slide, but we know what that looks like from our prior examples, but it is actually necessary, just not showing it for space. And you can see we did the hooking up the register file, so we have our 2 number to read inputs, so we set them to RA and RB from those bits from the instruction, and we have our what to write inputs, so I set the number to write based on the bits of the instruction, and the value I do by adding together our 2 register outputs. Questions? Code. Yes?
You're not actually using the opcode in this example because you already know it's going to be adding registers.
Question, I'm not using the opcode in this example because I'm assuming it's going to be adding yes. So in the real processor, we'll obviously need to add using the opcode somewhere to like not always add 2 registers together. Yes?
Do you also have to add the like for the 2 wires on the register file that you didn't show, did you just also set them?
Okay, so question is, don't I need to set destm to regnon and set reg input m to something? So if you do not specify inputs for source A, source B, input dest e dest m, they will default to regnon for you. So you don't have to do that, just to keep things simpler. And if you also, if you don't specify an input for dest E or dest M, you don't need to specify one for input E, input M. Okay, other questions? Yes? So the question is, since iGen bytes is 10 bytes, and we're only incrementing i2, is there an overlap? Yes. So if we only had add instructions, every time we're actually reading 5 instructions and ignoring all but the first. And we're allowed to do that. And that's going to, and on our full processor, we're going to be reading 10 bytes of instructions, which will often be more than one instruction, but not always. So the reason we're reading 10 bytes is the worst case. We don't really have a convenient way of choosing a different amount to read because we have to like look at the instruction to figure out how much we want to read. So it's just more convenient for us to just always read enough. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? Okay, so we've seen a bunch of HCL examples. Some just notes about if you're reading the book. So the book has a different HCL syntax in some ways. So the book calls things bools or ints. We just call them all wires. We don't distinguish between single bit values and multi-bit values, which our book does. The book has names like val c, and the book's HCL system, a bunch more things are hard-coded, so those names are required. You don't have to use that. If you don't like the name val c, you can use like constant value in your code and have it be maybe more readable. Mux has needed a fault case in RHCL. The book doesn't require that. We've just found that if not have people who omit a case in a mux often have a really hard time debugging things if we don't have well-defined behavior for what's the default. And I recommend, as I did in my example earlier, if you don't know what to put in the default case, put some bogus value that will like be really obvious in the output, because that will make debugging easier when you realize, oh, wait a moment, I forgot to handle an instruction here. Also, our book kind of had this built-in ALU, so we're not going to have that. So you might say, wait, what's an ALU? We haven't talked about that, and we haven't. So an ALU is a circuit that does computation. So typically the way these would work is that someone who designs circuits to do arithmetic would give us something which takes in two inputs and has an output and has some operation on those inputs where you can select the operation from like add, subtract, XOR, shift, you know, all the sorts of things you might imagine instructions do. And this is something that's often a big component of processors. And for our textbooks HCL, that was kind of supplied to students. We're just going to have you make one yourself. How do you make one? You just have a mux that chooses which result to do, which maybe is not the most, the way you, well, is not probably how you implement it in hardware, but it's going to be sufficient for our purposes. So, like, we can just do result, you know, equals op select equals, you know, equals some number 1, x plus y, op select equals equals 2, x minus y, and so on. So we can try to do it that way. If you're actually like taking an ECE design course, you'll learn that, oh, there's stuff that you can maybe do that's a little more efficient than that, but we're not going to be concerned about it. Some questions about ALUs? So something which comes up when we talk about ALUs is you say, oh, we have this ALU for doing arithmetic. So that's what's incrementing our PC, right? And generally, no. So our processor, as designed by the textbook, has one ALU, which is not where the PC increment is. That's a separate adder. You might say, but we have this thing which does adds. Why aren't we using it to increment the PC? And, well, there's a couple reasons for this. So one is that the sort of incrementing the PC operation we could do is much less general. So we can use a less complicated circuit for that than an ALU, which can do all sorts of math. The other reason is that we need to increment the ALU at the same time as we're actually doing a normal add. And those are different values, and we can only really do one in the same cycle. So we're going to have to have two different adders in our machine to handle that. Or else we need to take more cycles to do every instruction that involves an add. Because we have to do one cycle to have time to do the add to compute the next PC, and another cycle to have time to do the add to actually do the add for the instruction. That's not going to be something we're happy with. Okay. And I would say generally, we're going to be checking functionality, so we don't care if your code is, say, if you your code is organized like this or not. So, like, this is like building an ALU in HCLRS. We're not going to check for that. We're going to check, do the right values go in registers and memory? That's what we care about. So, questions on ALUs? Okay, so let's... So, I showed you an add CPU earlier. Right here. And let's say I wanted to modify that to support NOP. Which of these things, which of these places would I add a MUX? A case expression HCLRS. I'll give you a minute or so. Check with your neighbors, see if you agree. Who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A is a place where we need a MUX? Okay, a couple people. Okay, B. Okay, plurality probably. C. Okay, D. Okay, E. Okay, so. We have some people selecting most of them. We have a lot of people choosing B, C, and D. So let's talk about B first. B is the simplest one. So if we go back to what our add CPU was doing, here we're adding one. For NOP, we want to add, so we're adding two. For NOP, we want to add one, and then we're going to add a MUX to choose between them. Which, by the way, is also very similar to what you're going to end up doing on the lab this week. So why do we want to add one? Because if we go back to our instruction encoding, NOP instructions were 1 byte, add was 2. And we need to deal with that difference. So then we had the question about the inputs to the destination. So we need some way of making NOP instructions not write to a register. And RB here, the register we're going to write to with an add instruction, you might say, well, that's not part of the NOP instruction. But it's going to have a value because it's just going to be part of the next instruction that we're reading from. So the value doesn't make any sense for an NOP instruction, but it's going to not be something we've chosen. So we're going to want to make sure that it's something that's not going to cause us to overwrite a register. And probably the simplest way of doing this is to add a... drawing in the wrong place. Is to add something here where we choose regnon sometimes, based on whether it's an op or not. So that's probably the simplest option. Another option to avoid overwriting a register would to instead, and I don't recommend this option, but it is a valid option and a reason why you could have answered something else, is that we could have instead said, we're going to take the value of register B and just write it back in register B. That is also a valid solution. I don't recommend that, but that's an alternate solution. If you do that, you don't need to change Desti. Yes? So the first solution is that we set, to not modify a register, we set Desti to be the special regnon value, that 15, that says not to write anything, to ignore the input. Does that answer your question? So our second solution is that we just write back the value we just read from the same register number, because we know source B is the same, would be the same as Desti. So either of these will solve our problem of the NOP instruction needs not to modify any registers. I think the Desti solution is the better one, but either is fine. They both work. Okay, so my canonical solution is that we need to have the PC and the desk register. So then we have the other thing. So what about the register number to read inputs? So we absolutely could set them to something different, something like regnon to readout 0 for an NOP instruction, but it's not required. Like, the NOP instruction is still going to work the same as long as we suppress writing a register value. So that's not necessary, but it's not crazy to do. As for the program counter input, well, the way that's connected is it comes from the program counter register, the input to the instruction memory. There's nothing we want to change about that. For no matter what the instruction is, we want to read the instruction from that address. So there's nothing that changes. Yes? Question is, why is it plus 2 for the add CPU? So our add instruction, add is this opQ line. It's 2 bytes. Other questions? So we sort of know the process we're going to go about to add, say, a NOP instruction. So let's look at implementing some other instructions. And these are going to involve looking at some components we haven't gotten to yet. So here I have my, I just want to think about talking about our move instructions. So we have IRMoveQ, RRMoveQ, and MRMoveQ. So these are our move to register instructions. So we're missing the move from register to memory instruction. We'll get to that in a bit. And to talk about implementing these instructions, well, we need to access memory. So we need to read from memory. You might say, okay, well, we can read from memory. We have the instruction memory. But we have a problem. We can read one value every cycle from the instruction memory, because it has one input, is going to come from a register. We can't like wire that up to two different things and have them both work during the same cycle. Like, there's only going to be one value that's like the final value for each cycle. So we're going to have a second memory. We're going to have the instruction memory, and we're going to have a data memory. And our data memory is also going to support writing in addition to reading. So our instruction memory, we mentioned we put in an address, we got the value there. For reading, our data memory is going to work the same way. We're going to put in an address, and we're going to get the value at that address. But since our data memory supports reading and writing, it's going to have a way to, we're going to have to choose which we're doing. The way we're going to do that is that there's going to be a write enable and read enable signal. If read enable is one, the reading is going to work. If it's not, we're not going to get a useful value out. If the write enable signal is one, then a write's going to happen. You want to say, when does the write happen? And it's going to be that work the same way as register. So like registers, we're going to put in a value, and at the rising edge of the clock, that value is going to be written into memory. Yes?
Since we have two separate wires for read and write enable, is it possible for both of them to be enabled at the same time?
Question is, since we have separate read and write enable wires, can they be both be enabled at the same time? Yes, please don't do that. Yes? Question, if we are only trying to implement IR move queue and R move queue, would we need a data memory? No. So it's only this MR move queue instruction which is going to require it. And just because we need to read two different things from memory at once. One, the instruction, and something else. Okay, other questions? Okay. And like we've seen with the register file, each of these signals has a name in HTRS. You can look this up in the README documentation, the HTRS link at the top of the course website. But these are the names. We have mem input, mem output, mem adder. Those are the names we've chosen. They're almost the same names as the textbook, but just look them up when you need them. So you might say, wait a moment, we have two memories. Does that mean that the values for our program are different than the values for our program's data? You know, are they stored in different places? And the answer is kind of. So it's going to be the case that if we write to an address in the data memory, it's going to change stuff in the instruction memory. So they're accessing the same data. So they're basically two views of really the same memory. So maybe they're just one memory. We'll explain what's really going on when we talk about caches. So in a typical processor, there actually is some physical separation between the two memories, but they're synchronized in some way. Because they're not really memories. They're not really the main memory. They're really caches. As we'll learn when we talk about caches and exactly how these things would work. Okay, so we're talking about implementing these move to register instructions. So where are we going to need muxes of these places? So are we going to need it before the register index ports, so the source and destination signals? Are we going to need it for the value inputs, so the input E, input M, you know, the value to write inputs? Are we going to need it for the PC register's input? Now we're going to need it for the instruction memory address input. So give you a minute to think about that. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, a bunch of people. Okay, who still needs more time? Okay, so who thinks A is a case where we're gonna need muxes? Okay, a few people. B? Okay, most people. C? Less, but most people. D? Okay, so the way I think about this is, okay, so each of these writes different values to register, so we probably need B. Based on that, unless we can do something clever about using our two ports. Each of these instructions have different lengths. So RMOVEQ is a 2-byte instruction. So this is 2 bytes, and this is 10 and 10. So we're gonna need to increment the PC by different amounts, which means the PC register input is gonna need to change. And A, well, it seems like, wait a moment, well, we sometimes need to read a register, but it's always RxX. And we need to write a register, but it's always Roy. So it seems like we wouldn't need A, but we do. And this is, encoding is tricky. And we'll see about why exactly we do in a second. So let's talk about building this processor. So I'm going to first look, yes.
Yeah. So does the memory register move takes the memory of the RxX and write it to ROI, so it's read and write in one cycle?
So the question is, the MRMOVEQ does a read of memory and a write of something in one cycle? Yes. So it does a read of memory before the rising edge of the clock, and it writes the result to a register at the rising edge of the clock. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, so for talking about building these, I'm going to just go instruction by instruction. That's going to be how I'm going to do this. So I'm going to say, let's first draw what we need for RMOVEQ. So for RMOVEQ, we access the instruction memory. We split it up to get our register numbers. I'm going to connect source A and source B, even though we actually don't need source B, just because it's easy to do, and we know I'll need it eventually. And we know our destination is the same as source B. And we just take the value we read, feed it back in. So that's RMOVEQ. So then I'm going to say, let's add IRMOVEQ. So for IRMOVEQ, this is the same, except we need to write a different value. So I'm going to add a mux for the value we're writing. And because I know that we're going to have one case for RMOVEQ, where I'm going to say, if it's RMOVEQ, write the output of the register file, output A. If it's IRMOVEQ, we're going to want to write an immediate. So we're going to extract that part of the instruction, and that's going to be the second case of that mux. Questions on how I, why I'm doing that? Yeah. Question of the mux is deciding whether to use an immediate or register value? Exactly. So it's deciding between reg output A and something extracted from my 10 bytes. Other questions? Yes, back there.
What's in the immediate? Is it the register value or?
The question is, what's in the immediate? The immediate is the V, this value here. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. Yes, which is called reg input E if we look at our table, yes. So the mux would look, be what we're setting next to reg input RSD, which is reg input E in HCLRS. Other questions? Okay. So that adds I remove Q. And then we need to add M remove Q. And this gets surprisingly complicated. So one thing you might say is, wait, why did you do this mux here before dest D? Why are we choosing between the A and B register? And well, this here is not a typo. That's RB into RA. That is not a typo. It is actually the encoding our textbook authors chose. You might say, why did they do that? And the answer is, well, we have to compute an address. And we compute the address by taking our immediate and adding it to RB and putting that into the memory. And this is the same calculation we're going to do for the other move. So they need it to be consistent with the other move, the register to memory move, which is going to read from RA. So yes, this is weird because you would expect, oh, it's the second register number. It should be RB. No, it's not. It's RA. So we're going to have a mux to choose between that. And we also need to add the other machinery. So we have an extra case on our reg input emux here, which is going to come from our data memory. And we also need to set the input to the data memory to be that addition of the displacement, which is the same immediate value we used for IRMOVEQ. And the register value we just read reg output A, or B, reg output B. Yes. So question is yes. If it was DRA RB instead of DRB RA, we wouldn't have needed that mux in front of dest D. That's correct. Okay, other questions? Okay. And we also need to choose the APC. I guess something I'll note is that our textbook does this a little differently. Our textbook decides to use destm instead of destd for mrmoveq, which changes this slightly, but it's the same idea. We still need a mux in either case because we need to choose regnum in the appropriate case if we have using destm too. And that's where I'll finish up today.